Welcome to the DK UK podcast. My name is Daniel Kelly. DK UK is a hairdressing salon based in Peckham since 2014. Here in the salon, customers look at art instead of a mirror while they get their hair cut. This began as an art project and has grown into a successful business. The salon came about as a reaction to living in London, which is now a very expensive and overcrowded city, not leaving much space for artists to show their work outside of the commercial art world. I trained as a hairdresser before I went to art college, and after several years of trudging through the art world trying to make a living, I decided to combine the two areas of my life, art and hairdressing, and hey presto, haircuts in front of art. On the DK UK podcast, I will be chatting to a range of guests whilst giving them a haircut on the themes present in DK UK, such as how artists earn a living, public funding in the arts, and what sort of length do you want the fringe? I recommend listening to the podcast through headphones and hope you enjoy the chat. Any likes, shares, ratings, etc. would be greatly appreciated. And what was that? Here comes our client. Okay, better go. So what would you like to do with your haircut?
It's been a while. When was it?
Did I cut it last time?
You did. That was the last time. Yeah. So that was like a few months ago, wasn't it, at least? December.
Okay, yeah.
So it's quite long now. But I think I'd like to keep the length on the top and then shorter on the sides.
You've been brushing it back a bit.
Quite a little bit shorter on the sides.
Okay. So we sit in at the sides and build up the weight through the top.
It tends to grow out really fast, like here. And then it's sort of, you know, that kind of Terry Wogan hair shape.
Goes like that
after about 2 weeks. Which, I don't know if that's a good look or not.
I mean, it's definitely a look.
Is that a mulligan on our hair?
What I can do is, first of all, your hair's not super thick.
No.
So we can afford to like build up a bit of weight there, and it's not going to like bulge out so much. But where we are doing, I'll cut into it a little bit.
Okay, cool.
So we'll keep the length, but there won't be too much weight.
Great.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Cool.
Sounds good.
So customer reaction has been really good.
That's great.
Old customers have been sort of like blown away by the space and like how much bigger it feels.
It's bigger. It is actually bigger. Like, there is actually more space. Like
12%.
And then there's the feeling of more space.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a wind chill factor, isn't it? It's like a sort of like perception of space is it's probably about 30% bigger.
Yeah, and taking the ceiling away as well, if you take that.
That's true.
And what's been quite interesting since the refit has been some people have they've really struggled to remember what it was like before.
Really?
And I think that's quite nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but it's not changed much. I think you really managed to succeed in keeping what was good about it.
You should put up some heritage pictures, like down the arcade. Like, I had photocopy. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Send your memories in.
Well, this is phase three. So, there's been... when I first moved in, we just had one unit.
Yeah.
And we had this sort of, like, fake shop front on, which some students had installed as an exhibition. And then, a couple of months after, I took two units, which we've got at the moment, and sort of made it a bit more gallery like. And I guess the nice thing with this is with 2.5 years later, we've sort of tried to make it a bit more salon like. And that seems to be going well. I mean, I've also been trying to increase the online advertising a little bit to try and get more hairdressing customers in, you know, make it look a little bit more like a gallery, so more like a salon. And I think what we've really succeeded in doing is making it more comfortable for those customers who were coming expecting a sort of more of a standard sort of hairdressing salon.
Yeah, it's a bit
warmer, more comfortable.
Yeah. Classier basin.
Exactly, yeah, nice gel neck support.
And so you've got a new show coming up soon, like the end of the month.
Yes, Phoebe. Mm-hmm. Phoebe Davis. Yeah, we need to chat about getting your show down.
Yeah.
Phoebe has been working with Tate Exchange. And she's doing a video show.
Great.
Which is going to be like a back-to-back screen in the middle of the space on some scaff. And then the two chairs will face the screen.
Ah.
And it's sort of challenging stereotypes of female body perceptions and movement and intimacy. It's a sort of dance movement. Your show is—it's made the refit made it feel much more spacious.
Yeah.
But the exhibition has made it feel pretty claustrophobic. Chairs on the wall. Perhaps we should talk people through what we've got.
Oh, what's on the wall?
Yeah, so we sort of went to your studio and decided to get... Well, you can tell us a bit about it.
Yeah. Well, it's what we've got here. It's really a... I suppose it's like a selection of things that we've been experimenting with over the last couple of years. I never quite know what to think of them because they're sort of design in a way, but they're not design in a straightforward sense. I guess they're often like it's like a chair which is about a question of like chairness or something like that. It's like a philosophical pondering on the idea of a chair through a chair.
Something about design is filling a function, isn't it? And I think I see more of these as filling a function of questioning, which is more of what you get from an artwork potentially. Questioning the functioning of it in the world as a thing.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a weird selection of things. It's a couple of t-shirts, one with a half timbered pattern on it, like mock Tudor, one with a brick wall pattern. Then there's a chair which is looks like it's made out of putty, so it's like one to one size and you can sit on it, but it also looks like it's been, well, like almost like it's a model at the same time.
Yeah, sort of 3D model or something, isn't it?
And then next to that there's a basketball that's been cast in clay, which I suppose a lot of them are also about, like, is it the real thing, or is it like a model or a representation of that thing? So there's a basketball. It is a cast from a basketball, so it's got all of the knobbles on it, the kind of logos and stuff like that, but made out of clay. So obviously, like, exactly the opposite of what you want from a basketball normally.
And it's quite clear it's made of clay because you've still got the seam on the edge where it's been cast. Sort of thing.
But it's
the same. Clay's coincidentally the same colour, is it? Or have you...
Yeah, exactly. Pigmented? So, yeah. No, it's just, yeah, so it's a sort of earthenware clay, so it's almost the same colour you might expect to see a basketball.
Yeah.
So then what else have we got? I've got two scarves. One which is a kind of got a wood effect, which is known as the plank scarf. And then the other, which was a hot seller last Christmas, the insulation scarf, which is the international drawing symbol of insulation, the kind of thing that architects always like putting on their drawings, but drawn onto the scarf. So, in both of them, there's again this idea that somehow the representation and the sort of the thing that it is, there's some sort of relationship with it, whether it's the symbol becomes the symbol of insulation is a bit of insulation that you wrap around your neck.
I've got to say that's the sort of the piece in the show that
has made a show click for people.
Really?
Like, yeah, that's the sort of, like, that's been the access point in.
Oh, that's interesting.
For audiences who don't know you or your work. Or,
why do you think that is?
For me, a lot of the things, or the way I've been talking about it, I mean, I think in the salon, you need quite a clear one-liner to sort of grab people's attention.
Yeah.
They're looking at art while they're getting a haircut, so it's sort of they've got time, but it might not be the main reason that they're here, mm-hmm. sort of thing, which is quite nice. Mm. And for me, the sort of line I've been using has been this sort of, you're interested in this form and the function of like the representation of something and the thing.
Yeah.
And the scarf, I think, just sort of like toes that line in quite a sort of clear, witty sort of way.
That's interesting, because it's also the one I would have thought would be like the most obscure, because it relies on you knowing a bit of information, which is quite an obscure bit of information, which is like, how do you draw insulation?
Yeah.
But I guess once you explain it, then maybe it
exactly,
maybe it makes
yeah.
it clear.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of the others, like, they work in a very, I always think they work in a very kind of blunt visual way. So you know, what I'm sitting in front of is a window, which is kind of one to one size. Like, you could definitely, you know, it's definitely the size you could have a window, but it's a screen print, and there's a sort of what seems to me to be like an obvious relationship of like, it's a picture of a window, but it also almost operates like a window, like it provides a view. So here I am looking out onto a field of like a really nice yellow basically. Yeah. So it's not trying to be like it's sort of not trying to be a picture, like pictorial thing in a way, even though it is a picture of a window.
Yeah.
But it's not it's more like as if it was a window, if that makes sense. So it acts like a view. So it does a lot of the things that windows do, which I suppose is also what a lot, you know, pictorial things do too. So you put a picture on the wall, and then suddenly you have an instant view. Apart from here, the view isn't landscape, isn't like a thing you could look at. Apart from the device or the architectural apparatus, the window.
Yeah. And then the other big hitter has been the painting. That's taken a little bit of explanation of people.
Oh, yeah.
Mies van der Rohe house.
Oh, well, yeah, the Philip Johnson glass house.
Johnson? Oh,
yeah,
my gosh,
I've
been telling people the wrong.
That would make Mies very angry. He was angry enough when Philip Johnson built it.
Really?
it's got a long story, that one. Obviously, it's got the story of the original image, which is
the painting. Yeah.
So, which actually goes back all the way to Mies and to Philip Johnson. So, when Mies was designing the Farnsworth House, which is a glass house, Philip Johnson was, you know, in much admiration of this radical idea for architecture. So he was so enamoured with that idea that he decided to build his own version of it. And because Johnson was building it on his own land with his own money for himself, he could obviously get it built pretty quick, whereas Mies had a client and a difficult relationship with that client, and it took a lot longer to be built. So Mies, you know, kind of in a sense invented the idea of the glass pavilion as domestic space, but Philip Johnson kind of copied it but built it first. So there's a story that when Johnson showed Mies, took him to see the glass house, Mies was so angry that he like walked away and like walked off back into New Canaan. So there's a sort of, you know, there's a sort of idea of the, like, I suppose like the copy somehow embedded in Philip Johnson's version of the glass house.
Yeah.
But then this, but this, so that's like the very, very backstory.
Yeah.
And then there's the backstory of the glass house itself. So there's a painting, a Poussin painting, that's inside Johnson's house on a sort of metal frame, like a billboard.
That painting did exist in the glass house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah. I'm telling it right. Yeah.
So, and when you sit on the moose chair in that house,
we should explain that this is what the other hairdressing customers are faced with.
Yeah.
This is the other focus work. Yeah.
So yeah, and so then if you're sitting in the glass house on a moose chair, looking at the Poussin, it blends into the actual landscape around the house, like the horizon, and the trees.
What they positioned the painting so it actually lines up with the horizon.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Wow.
And so then first of all, this project kind of switches them around so that it puts the glass house into the painting. And then I sent that image off to Darfeng, which is the famous oil painting village in Shenzhen. And what came back a couple of, about 6 weeks later, was an oil painting of that image. And so here in DK UK, they hang together, the sort of digital collage and then the oil painting version of it.
And this village in China, it's a long tradition, isn't it?
Well,
in China, of like homage.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I've had a few art historians in who are saying that it's not seen as copying in China. This is a sort of quite an ancient process of,
I think there's different cultural attitudes towards the copy.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very, in a way, it's very sort of modern Western idea that the sort of idea of the original being the most important thing, or the myth of like authorship and so on and so forth, like is really a kind of early 20th century invention.
Something came with the sort of impressionists and sort of that sort of
Or, I suppose...
Lonesome artists struggling to find new methods of representation.
Yeah. So if you wanted to learn how to become an architect, the way you did it was to copy things, basically. Like to sit in, in somewhere like the V&A's cast courts, where there's already copies of... some of the most important bits of building and sculptures in the Western world, and you kind of learnt from imitation.
Yeah.
That's totally different in, or apparently totally different in architectural education now, where the best student is the most original.
I was watching that BBC drama last night, The Replacement. Have you heard about this? Where the woman gets pregnant and then she's worried about her replacement taking her job, but it's set in an architect's practice.
Uh-huh.
And there's lots of these funny split screen shots with the evil person in the background and Google SketchUp playing in this new library that they're building in Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering how.
I have to check that out.
The difference that computer design must have made to architecture. Like, how did they do that before?
Yeah.
I mean, did you train at a time?
Well,
with computers or
no? I was just I was just on the cusp. So I think I learned pretty much on the drawing board, like how to do a measured perspective.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things. And I used to love the act of drawing on tracing paper with a rotary pen. So nice. And if you made a mistake, you'd have to scratch it out. But it was like I really used to enjoy just the process of doing it and the kind of precision. And all of that stuff is now kind of automatic, like lines snap to one another, so you don't have to worry about that. Like, you don't have to worry about the ink bleeding because it's you're holding the nib on the paper too long, those kinds of things. But
so when did you train doing drawing,
mm-hmm.
blueprint drawings of buildings,
basically, yeah,
different views to get your sort of mm-hmm. head around the space, basically.
Yeah. But then at the same time, the computers were arriving, so there was a computer room, special room where you had to go to use the computers,
right.
And there was but what I really liked when I was doing my degree, I really got into the colour photocopier, which was pretty exciting. I loved the actual collage as well. I was pretty good with either an old-fashioned photocopier or a colour laser copier, which was pretty cutting edge at that moment.
So your style is quite collaged.
I was using it. Yeah. I don't know what I was. I mean, I don't know what I was doing with it, but. But then when things like Photoshop came on, I was so excited. And I still love working in Photoshop.
Yeah.
It's such a great...
What do you use it for? Cutting bits together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all kinds of things, actually. Like to make a drawing now, I suppose it's just like a really... Like making a digital drawing, it's like a really... complex way of bringing together lots of different stuff, like bits off the images, like downloaded off the internet, things that are scanned in, things that you've drawn yourself, like bits you've drawn in Illustrator, things you've like 3D modeled, and so Photoshop's like the sort of place where all of those different bits can come together, and you can sort of, I suppose, like really control and take collage to a place which is really different from, if you think collage is that act of like chopping up different things from very different places and sticking them together. It always had a very kind of like a real kind of juxtaposition. There was a real sort of juxtapositional quality to the act of collage, and I think with Photoshop you get this really like smooth, seamless join where
you've got this great leveler in the screen, haven't you? Yeah.
So it's interesting that it was developed as a kind of almost like a kind of digital version of a darkroom, I suppose, like where you can adjust photographs. But if you think of it as a drawing tool, it's incredible.
Yeah.
The things you can do with it.
I was quite excited about learning Illustrator because I'd just worked with Photoshop initially, but
then
figuring out what Illustrator does, which is different, was quite because actually what I use Illustrator is sort of better now.
How did you get on with SketchUp?
SketchUp was pretty straightforward. I learned it once years ago and then relearned it again recently, and that was pretty intuitive, I think. And as soon as you start figuring out how to drop in the textures, that's when it becomes quite fun, I think, isn't it?
But we were kind of doing a little bit of work together, right, for that show in Norway.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you built a model,
yeah,
in SketchUp, and then sent it over, and then I did a bit more in it and sent it back, and we sort of designed it together, basically.
Yeah.
But I remember you saying, I quite like the feeling of like zooming around this space and pulling the handles of things, changing their size and so on.
Feeling like God.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I imagine, I'm slowly coming around to the idea of being an architect, just sort of sat there twiddling and clicking and then showing up on a building site.
Yeah, it does feel a lot like being God, but a lot of the time being an architect, I have to say, Daniel.
And actually, the talk that I came to as part of the Radical Essex thing.
Oh, yeah.
You were at.
Yeah.
I forget which speaker now, but it was the sort of like Labour left wing guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And the way he was talking about environments and buildings, and to have that as your trade, and it, to be talking about it has such a powerful effect, the built environment.
Mm.
To actually be talking about it quite critically felt
almost
insensitive or something. And I guess you have to have that level of critique on it because you're doing it and you're building it. But actually, like, it has such a powerful. I'm struggling to get my words out. Such a powerful effect on people's lives that they don't realise. That I imagine the people, the residents who are sat in these estates, hearing people talk of them and the power that the building and therefore the architect has had over these people's lives in history must be.
It's a funny. I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, obviously, in some ways, you say, yeah. And a building is a. It's like an ultimate form of control in some sense. But then the question often is, and I think this makes it difficult for architects, is that when the control doesn't really come from the architect, it comes more from like the entire scenario that creates that, the possibility for that thing to be built at that moment. So that's, you know, from very, very clear manifestations of power like economics, like viability of finance, government policy, like planning control.
And but I suppose we can see in that now, aren't we? Like how in the post-war, there was a big council, build a lot of houses for people, you know, give architects a bit of freedom, make them create good quality of lives for people. And now it feels like it squeezes every inch of space out of them. You've got flat screen TVs, don't worry about giving people small rooms. It's like profit seems to me to be put over quality of life now.
Yeah, so it's exactly you get the built environment, you get the buildings that society gets, the buildings that it deserves, and the buildings that it kind of wants, really. You know, in that sort of post-war like settlement. Both in terms of rebuilding but also like the construction of the welfare state, both as a organisational thing, a sort of abstract thing, an aspirational thing, but also as a physical thing, you know, like how architecture and planning was a central part of like, how do you manifest those ideas or that desire of society to kind of come into the world.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which then means, oh yeah, it's like how do you build schools and what kind of schools do you build or hospitals or housing, and that they all embody a kind of social attitude of like, you know, what education or what living or what community or what city is, who it's for and who it belongs to, and obviously, 21st century. London, 21st century Britain is a very different place from, you know, 1952.
Yeah.
So I guess the question then perennially for architects is like, well, what kind of agency do they have? What can they do? What is their role? Can they do anything more than deliver, you know, a project which essentially exists? So if you're working now, many architects would find themselves in a situation where the building is pretty much designed even before they're involved,
right.
Designed in terms of like the finances all worked out, the spreadsheets already say that, you know, it's gonna essentially be this big, it's gonna have this much circulation space, this much like lettable or saleable area. And so as an architect then, you know, what are you left, you know, what's left for you to actually work on? It's like a bit of a fancy treatment to a kind of economic formula. Or, you know, all the other view is that a sort of architect's role is to completely question the brief, to be able to, you know, kind of invent new possibilities in a sense, to continue that idea that you can build forms of, like, not necessarily utopia, but like some form of idealism into every project. But
must be a long battle.
Yes, I would say that it is.
Was that part of? I'd like to talk just a little bit about Fat.
Oh yeah,
because I mean, what you said just struck a chord then.
Yeah,
you sort of, I mean, to explain to people that don't know, you're in a successful architecture practice called FAP.
Yeah.
Maybe you can describe it.
In the 90s.
I wanted to ask you about FAT and then your decision to disband in that.
Okay.
Go into where you find yourself today, because that seems to, my understanding, fit with what you've just been talking about, perhaps.
Well, I guess like FAT sort of started almost by accident, in a sense. And it was an idea about architecture, about cities, but at a time when collectively, and it was very collective.
How many people were in?
Oh my God! At the beginning, it was uncountable.
Oh really?
What was very unusual about it was that it wasn't an architecture office. Like, it was a thing that was about architecture, but in the broadest sense.
Ah,
and we didn't think we could. We didn't even imagine that we would ever build anything,
right?
Or that
was it straight from college?
Yeah,
yeah.
And even the idea that actually the architecture shouldn't be about building, like, you know, in a strange way, like designing a project. Not that any of us knew it at the time, but designing a project is, in a strange way, the worst place to think about architecture, because it's sort of you just don't. Those times I don't have the space to do it. And you can't. I don't know. It's difficult to undermine the essential idea of architecture when you're also trying to make it, I suppose. So we made a lot of, I suppose, different kinds of projects. Often we called them art projects, they were strangely often more curatorial.
Right.
But using sites in the city, so things like bus shelters. For sale signs outside houses, business cards, shopping bags, all these kinds of what we later sort of realised all points of communication in the everyday landscape of the city.
Like, yeah.
And essentially co-opting them as a space for, of shorthand, is art, like for other forms of media. And often we would essentially commission projects for those sites from a whole range of different kind of cultural practitioners, so artists or photographers, sometimes very successful, sometimes still at art school, often a kind of a real mix. So this was a time when that idea of cross-disciplinary forms of practice, the idea of the collective as a sort of alternative organisation.
What date, when was this?
It's like 93, 94, okay. 95. Yeah. In fact, sort of came into existence legally in 95. So we did a whole load of projects like that over, I suppose, about 10, 15 years.
And where were they existing?
Where?
Yeah.
Oh, well...
So artists and photographers making things with stuff from the landscape, for sale signs.
For those things. So the first one was a thing called... was for advertising sites on bus shelters.
Yeah.
So in a way, that feels like quite familiar, idea nowadays. I think then it was a little bit more unusual. So that was like 250 sites across London.
Yeah.
So it was quite a big show, in a sense.
Was it commissioned by the? Who's it commissioned by?
No, we found a way to lease it, to lease the sites, and then bill the people who wanted to do it. So it was a sort of
amazing
way of kind of mobilizing, maybe you call it like crowdfunding these days.
Yeah.
But that
sort
led
of
to
making a comment on the finance of those things as well.
In a way, yeah. In a way, then that led on to another one, which we commissioned like 3D installations around bus shelters, up and down, well, mainly up and down Tottenham Court Road, but like around central London. But that was then commissioned directly from the people who own the bus shelters. And I think Camden Council too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were always about putting like artwork into kind of sites that you wouldn't expect. You know, like when you're walking down the street and you see a for sale sign, it's got a certain amount of information on it, i.e. that house is for sale. You know, here's the people you should call to if you're interested in buying it. But in that project, we worked, I think it was down one street, and on the two sides of a for sale sign, one you'd have the artist's work, and on the other side, you'd have the artist working with the family who lived, or the person who lived in that house. So you'd have like a kind of, if you look one way down the street, you'd have one exhibition. If you look the other way down the street, you'd have a different exhibition. But also just the idea that you could be in a street and in an exhibition at the same time. That sort of merging of the idea of the gallery. So we often described it as like ways of making architecture without, you know, using all of the things which you normally think of as architectural, like walls, windows, floors, doors, those kinds of things.
And so what are you classifying as the architecture, like the experience?
Yeah, or like how you set up relationships, how you kind
with
the, of
someone participating and sort of existing
like,
with it.
Exactly.
Idea. Yeah.
So if you think of like, you know, the sort of, I suppose like the White Cube gallery space as a sort of very clear definition of a certain form of like art practice.
Yeah.
But you could also think of it as a very very clear idea of a certain way that architecture works, and the idea of the gallery, art and architecture being somehow in cahoots in creating a kind of experience, a set of relationships between, you know, artwork, artist, spectator, but also with market, with media, with other ideas of culture.
Yeah, which is sort of more under the surface.
Yeah. And so I guess our very simple idea is, what if you explode the architecture, then what other kinds of relationships can you set up? What does it mean if you, exactly like here, like what does it mean to sit in front of an artwork while you get your hair cut?
Yeah.
What does it mean to sit in a bus stop and while you're waiting for a bus, not look at an advert for a Kit Kat, but to look at something which doesn't perhaps declare itself quite so easily, or its message isn't quite so clear. So in that sense, there was a lot of like thinking about what is architecture, what role does it have, what are its powers, or how might you even think about things which are completely, you know, not in a professional sense architecture, not the kind of things you'd find in a, you know, magazine or book about architecture, but understand the world in architectural terms.
Yeah.
So that was like the sort of key beginning idea of that, which sort of became more and more architectural. At a certain point, we decided that actually, yeah, it would be a good idea to try and build things. And in order to do that, you have to really, we felt anyway, that you have to begin to understand the ways in which, like, the, you could say, like, the commissioning process for buildings, the professional process, the kind of the ways in which you have to act as an, if you want to be thought of as an architect.
Yeah. Is that like art school, where they don't really teach you all that stuff?
For sure.
Architecture school, yeah. Where it's actually be very useful.
Yeah. And so then we were kind of, I think we're relatively successful, not in terms of a commercial you know, output, but in terms of actually building actual buildings, which obviously exceeded our initial imagination of what was even possible, but also to be able to build buildings with a kind of idea, with a kind of concept behind them, which was we felt very, you know, an unusual thing to do, or certainly with the kind of attitude which we had early on, which was quite in your face. I think it's quite like aggressive, quite kind of anti the I suppose the mainstream taste of architecture at that moment.
Yeah, which was what?
Well, we were always, it was always about, so if
but what was the mainstream taste?
If the mainstream taste was like, oh, like a sort of abstract idea of architecture, you could say like a kind of neo-modernism in that sense,
yeah,
something like that.
Like the QVC building, sort of.
Well, not so much that. More like I'd say more kind of like more sort of modernist, I would say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, less postmodernist. Yeah. So this was like when all of that postmodernism had been like thought was like everyone had tried to forget it, like tried to sweep it under the carpet, tried
right.
to imagine it, it never happened. And what you know, no one would speak about it even. Our attitude was actually, well, let's try and make architecture do things which I suppose had a lot of resonance with at least early postmodernism, which was like make it full of content, make it have lots of references, that architecture can never be, you could say, like abstract. It can never be outside of fashion. It can never be like non-political. It can never be timeless, can never be all of those kinds of things which architecture was often thought of, or judged by, or imagined by. Ours was a sort of it was like yes to decoration. We used to have slogans, we had a slogan called "Taste, Not Space," which was at the time when you could say like. Deconstruction was like, you know, or Bill, sort of Frank Gehry's Bilbao, Guggenheim was the kind of high point of what architecture, kind of contemporary architecture imagined itself to be about. We were like, no, actually, it's not space, it's not like complex shapes, it's not pushing structure to its limits.
Yeah.
It's not about like digital possibilities of making incredibly complex, like double, triply curved objects. Actually, it's the surface, like what the wallpaper that you put on the wall, which actually contains all of the real politics of the built environment. It's the thing which is, you know, the thing which architects we would claim at that time would never talk about,
right.
Taste.
Yeah,
would never acknowledge that it really existed. Was the thing where you would find. In the most visceral way, like issues of class, issues of value, that actually it was in that, you could say, almost the decorative, that really you found the like hardcore like politics.
Yeah.
And so we were, you know, in that sense we were like very kind of like bad, like naughty, doing all of the wrong things, but at the same time like arguing that architecture was about like a much broader social and political issues, rather than it trying to mimic like sculpture, let's say.
I've got to say that blue building on Hackney Road, the first time I saw that as an art student who'd just come to London learning about postmodernism and trying to put things in historical progression kind of blew your mind a little bit, because you say you've got these sort of layering of historical motifs, but you just could not place that at all.
Sean's house. And we'd also, I think, by that time, like actively embraced postmodernism because it was so like important.
Because it was so out of fashion.
Yeah. which is completely case. Like, there's a show that just opened yesterday at the RIDA, which is about the two buildings which are designed for the city of London. So the first one was by Mies van der Rohe, which is like an abstract, obviously Mies tower, which didn't get built. And then number one poultry is James Stirling and his last building, which was built, that kind of weird, striking building opposite the Bank of England.
Which,
and so there you see exactly a sort of like postmodernism versus modernism. But now it's something which is a legitimate and interesting topic, which of course it always was. But I think we had much more of an agenda. We were like, I think we imagined ourselves much more like a band, in that if you're in a band, that's exactly how you operate.
So do you think it was always, was it always destined to come to an end then?
Yeah, probably. I think so. Yeah. Like, it was.
What's impressive from my understanding is that you actually did do that, rather than it become a sort of watered down, lucrative version or something.
Well, I think we sort of faced the choice.
You stuck to your guns.
It's like, would we become an office?
Yeah.
And an office is obviously like bureaucratic and economic, or would we stay like a project, which is like, you know, I guess about an idea. And I think at the end of the day, it was pretty clear that it was an idea. It wasn't an office.
Yeah.
So it was a thing you could end, and it was a thing you could walk away from. Which is great.
Yeah, I mean, that's nice to hear, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now I'm on my solo career. So
now you've got your own office.
So it's the equivalent of like, you know, the sort of jazz rock solo double album.
Do you think the sort of retirement reunion?
Well, you know, opens office. Depends on the tax bill, obviously.
Yeah.
But
I mean, that brings us quite neatly to the stuff here.
Yeah.
You know, you're still sort of treading.
Yeah. I think what's...
I mean, that's nice for me, and I hope that people listening will put these objects in a bit of sort of perspective.
Yeah.
Because coming from an art background, it's hard for me to understand.
Sure.
Like, where the boundaries are between architecture and display and function and all these sort of questions.
Yeah.
So now you're sort of building buildings?
Well, in a way, sort of carrying on exactly the same way that things did at FAT. So it's like combination of, you know, like a bigger scale of like master plan projects, like buildings, interiors, exhibitions, objects, like, you know, like a very broad range of things.
Yeah.
Like some of which are clearly like professional, you know, things you'd expect an architecture office to do. Other things, like, you know, like a lot of the stuff which is in the room here is not really what you'd expect an architecture office to do.
But
I think that's like, basically, that's been my attitude like right from the start, is that actually to try to define architecture by like professional definition of like someone who designs buildings is like to fundamentally misunderstand like architecture as an idea in the world of how it organises space, people, material, etc. How it organises those things in space. But also, you know, there's a phrase from an Austrian architect, Hans Holland, which is like everything is architecture. And in some ways, I don't think there's any way you can disagree with that. Like it's both, you know, St Paul's Cathedral, but it's also the all of the stuff which happens around it and in it. And I think to understand what architecture can do, even when you begin to define it professionally, you have to be able to think in that or understand it in a much broader context.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what I try to do. That's like why I think somehow it's as important to make t-shirts, to write about architecture, to teach it, to as well as to design it, like it, because it is actually all of those things. It's not just, you know, one aspect of it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually, was the conscious effort to sort of keep up with the teaching, or has that been a financial
push? I think at times the financially it's been really fantastic. Like it's supported me in ways which like conventional or like professional work couldn't. But at the same time, it's also like a brilliant space to think about things that, with thanks to the incredible hard work of the students that I work with, but also to be able to, you know, have a space to talk about things in an academic context is really useful, challenging, exciting. And
it draws you out of yourself, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's I find it a great compliment to like trying to run an office as well. The opportunity is different, you know, and it works at different speeds as well, which is, I think, also interesting. Like, buildings take just such a long time to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, even this space, Daniel, like, we would have been talking about it for, like, almost a year or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe. And
we've got 12 square metres.
Yeah. And that's, like, totally normal. It's not, like, I don't know how you felt. Maybe you felt like, oh my God, why, you know. I know we were looking at different spaces and so on and so forth. But that, you know, that's part of the, you know, all those practical things are part of the act of, like, trying to build something.
So,
things move very slowly in architecture. And, you know, teaching moves at a different speed, writing moves at a different speed, making stuff moves at a different speed. So, like, being able to have those, like, not only different ways of thinking, but and different kind of levels of control, but also different timescales happening, I think it's like a lifesaver for me, basically.
Yeah, for your insanity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how's China going?
China?
Is that your next big thing?
It is. Yeah. It is. Opening October. So off there next week to...
Tell us about that quickly. That's an exhibition, is it?
It's an exhibition for the V&A. For the V&A in a new design museum in Shenzhen called Design Society. So that's the new gallery.
Yeah.
A new institution, basically.
Set up by the V&A?
No. It's
hosting. So the V&A institution is hosting.
The V&A. Yeah, the V&A kind of have a gallery there for, I think, like 3-4 years, something like that. And what the V&A are doing for Design Society is showing essentially the story of 20th century design in a wider narrative that Design Society is telling, which goes from like Chinese antiquity to the, you know, immediate present. The V&A have got a role in like being part of that story. So it's great.
Big brief.
Ours is like it's called Values of Design, and it's about essentially how in the 20th century a series of different values, different ideas of what the you know, what design role is, what it does, what its value to society is, emerge. So, you know, is it about things becoming more high performance? Is it about things becoming like more affordable? Is it about solving problems? Is it about, you know, creating identity? All of these kinds of, you know, different, I suppose, aspects of design, if you sort of think of that change of into a world of mass production, into a globalized world, those kinds of thing. So yeah, so we're off to meet contractors next week.
Is the gallery's already built then?
It's being built. So it's a big new museum. Yeah. And so we have big space inside that. So it's all under construction at the moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's exciting, very exciting. Fantastic. And it's very exciting to be in Shenzhen as well. It's such a fascinating and strange and kind of, yeah, like a place which feels like it's part of which is still developing, still becoming somewhere. So it's very, very exciting. Very exciting. Yeah. Yeah.
And what's the longest term thing you're excited about now? Have you got a sort of something you're still going to be doing in 10 years' time?
No doubt. No doubt. I don't know. It's more, Daniel, it's more like it's often like it feels like one of those acts where they spin plates, you know, and like.
Yeah.
Everything.
Conversations all the way down there. That it's like, yeah,
exactly.
Chat about it. Some wax on your hair.
Sure.
Dry shampoo or.
Well, whatever you think, Daniel. I'm in your hands.
I'm gonna try this. See what happens. It's a bit long for wax. Do you use anything?
Not much actually.
I mean, you could put a bit of gel on it or something when it's wet to just stop it going fluffy if you wanted to. Okay. Voila.
Amazing.
So short around the sides,
yep.
Built up a little bit of length through here, mm-hmm. but I've cut into that quite a lot, so there's not too much weight. Around the curves of the head, mm-hmm. left it quite a lot longer on top, so you can flop that around forwards, backwards.
Great.
All
lovely.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Great.
Well, I never. Very interesting. Thanks for listening to the DKUK podcast. I hope you enjoyed that. I would also like to thank Arts Council England for their continued support of DKUK. Open School East for helping me get the recordings off the ground, and Joey Four for this great music you can hear underneath. For more information about DKUK, you can check out the website, which is www.dkuk.biz. And as I said, any likes, shares, ratings on the iTunes store, friends to tell about through social media would be greatly appreciated. And if you're in Peckham, come and get a haircut and have your own chat. Thanks a lot. Bye.